Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, the International Director of Jesuit Refugee Services reflects on the Christian message of peace and hope after a visit to displaced people on the island of Sri Lanka that was racked by a war for over 25 years. All the lonely people. Christmas is traditionally a time for getting together with our families. But let's spare a thought for the plight of the lonely who have nobody with whom to spend the festive season. And as I've discovered, the number of people living alone nowadays is skyrocketing. And Vatican centuries. Find out more about why the popes returned to Rome from Avignon by listening to the 21st episode in our series that looks at the lives and legends of the people and places that went into the making of the Vatican. This year saw an end to a long-running civil war on the island of Sri Lanka that pitted Tamil separatist rebels against government troops. Over 90,000 people were killed during the 25-year war, and tens of thousands of others were displaced in the conflict zone. Father Peter Bales is the International Director of Jesuit Refugee Services and has just returned from a visit to Sri Lanka, where he met many of those displaced by the war. He sat down with my colleague Chris Altieri and reflected on how, despite the massive suffering caused by this conflict, the people he saw are placing their hope in their children, the future generation, just as we at Christmas place our hope in Jesus, who came to us as a child.
Yes, I'd just like to tell you a little bit of a story of my recent journey to Sri Lanka. I visited people who have been displaced by the war after having gone through a terrible time, seeing a bloodbath of the war in Vani in the north, which then ended in May. And we met a group of eight families near Trincomalee who have also come home. And there was this one young widow with three children, and she said about what is her dream, a wish after having lost her husband in the aerial bombardment. She said, "My wish is that the three children I have get that same education as my husband would have liked them to have." For us, reflecting on reconciliation, issue was not reconciling after war. It was a hope and a future for the children. And again, in another place, in Mana district, refugees who have been in the detention camps had been brought home. But as I said, the homes are destroyed, their minefields that were put up in the church, St. Anthony's Church, a whole church full as a refugee camp. And here the people having shelter in the house of the Lord and the children on the floor learning, studying. And that's something great I experienced with the people, the Tamil people there who have suffered so much, that their future are the children. It made clear to me why we celebrate so much Christmas, the child, the hope, the future in our broken world, because the new beginning comes always with the next generation. And there's hope. Life continues. And I think God could have not, it did not even have a better way than to give us this hope, this future, by becoming himself one of these children in this world, which, yes, there's always a future. Like for that widow, her children, they will grow up, they will study. Like the people in the church, their children will grow up. In the midst of this family of eight people, two men have lost their legs and four are widows. Amidst all of that, the child, the children, the next generation, that's the hope. And that's how God came. It's the best way, and that's why we celebrate in our broken world Christmas so much. We celebrate it with the pain of this broken world, but also with that great hope
Of course, one of the glaringly obvious things about the story of the Nativity, in the broader story, which is that our Lord and Savior was himself a political refugee, spent his infancy as a refugee.
Yes. He himself, in his very first days, was a refugee, persecuted. He has chosen that fate to be one of the least.
Father, if you had one thing, just one thing that you would like our listeners around the world of which to be mindful at this season, what would that be?
Tell the people in charge to stop the wars. There's never a winner. When one sees the people without their legs and those paralyzed in the hospital, like in Mano and Vavunia, after the war has ended, thousands of people without leg, families broken, widows, on both sides speaks Tamil Sinhalese. One asks oneself, and who is now the winner? Was that necessary? It is not necessary. These wars will never bring a solution. Stop them. And let's not believe we can solve issues in the world with this. That's why the Christmas message is a message of peace to the world. What the angels proclaim, what the innocent, powerless child symbolizes, peace and the hope comes from there, and the wars have never helped. Please, let's aim for peace in our own lives. There's enough quarrel in the world. Let's try the best not to add to the quarrels, but to have peace. I wish peace. That's a desire for the people in Sri Lanka. That's a desire for all the people who are present in conflict zones.
That was Father Peter Bales, International Director of Jesuit Refugee Services, speaking to Chris Altieri.
Rejoice, rejoice, Emmanuel shall come to thee, O Israel.
All the lonely people, where do they all come from?
Christmas is drawing near, and it's a time that we traditionally celebrate in the company of our families. But what about those people who have nobody with whom to spend the festive season? As I've been finding out, there are more and more lonely people in Britain today, not just at Christmas, but throughout the whole year. We are living longer, and increasingly we are living alone. Statistics predict that by the year 2020, more than 2 out of 3 British households will be people living on their own. It's estimated that already 1 million elderly people in the nation don't see a friend or a neighbour during the course of an average week. But whilst most of those suffering from loneliness do tend to be the elderly, observers say more and more people from all age groups and all social milieu are falling into this category. But why is there so much loneliness in today's society? And how is the church reaching out to offer comfort and companionship to these isolated people? Siobhan Garibaldi is a trustee of the St. Vincent de Paul Society in London, and as a volunteer, often visits lonely people in their homes.
Well, I think that loneliness goes across the age range, from children being left to their own devices while their parents go to work, to the elderly whose family are nowhere near or too busy coping with their own lives to help. It goes across the social scale, from the materially poor to the well-off. And it also goes across all nationalities, from our own indigenous population to the thousands of immigrants pouring into the country, many of whom have left their families behind in their quest for work. I think that the breakdown of the family unit, with many, many marriage breakups, causes an awful lot of single parents feel in a position of loneliness as they struggle to make ends meet and haven't got the time or the money to go out and make social visits. So it's very much across the board, and I think there are many contributing factors as to why loneliness is so prevalent today.
Monsignor John Furnival is a parish priest in the Liverpool area, and he agrees with Siobhan that it's not just old people who suffer from loneliness and isolation.
I think actually more and more it's not just confined to the elderly It is very much those who are on the younger age bracket, and perhaps people who are out of work, people who have been put out of their own home, people of that kind who would, you know, come into the younger age bracket. So it is a problem amongst younger people too, where perhaps there's disillusionment and alienation from their own families.
It's a widely held assumption that those suffering from loneliness are usually poverty-stricken. But as Siobhan makes clear, these people are quite often materially well off.
If somebody needs a visit, hopefully we're there to make that visit and to befriend them. That does go right across the economic scale. People who are well off can also be lonely because their families are busy in their day-to-day lives. I think we live in a 24-hour culture where people are racing about, not just during the day now, but also in the evening and during the night. Many people work shifts. And that affects people who have got money and also people who haven't got money. I think everybody at the end of the day is suffering because of our 21st century living.
Material well-being, though, is no substitute for the companionship of family and friends. And it's little wonder that people living on their own are more likely to fall prey to feelings of depression and anxiety. Monsignor Furnival says that many of the lonely people he visits in his parish are severely depressed.
I think at times morale can be very low. I visit a lady whose husband has gone into a geriatric unit who's suffering from Alzheimer's. And they were together for 60 years and now have to be apart. And I think it's a heartbreak for her, for the wife, because the husband is not really conscious of the separation, but she's very acutely conscious of it, is in her own home, very lonely, and she often phones me simply to have a voice at the other end of the phone and a break in the, you know, what is for her a very long day and a very tearful day, I suspect. So there are people like that who've been separated on health grounds and so on. And I think that would be, you know, one that I'd single out amongst a number of others, really, in that situation. People who have spent their lives together and now forcibly separated, unfortunately.
It can be depressing sitting at home by yourself. But even going out and about can be just as bad sometimes because it shows up the contrast with the lives of other people, as Siobhan explains.
It's very easy when you're living on your own to feel depressed. Even when you're not actually in the house yourself, you don't have to be in a quiet environment to feel depressed. I think something that exacerbates the problem greatly is the fact that if you do go out and about, everybody around and about seems to be having, you know, a good time, particularly when you see people out in groups and you yourself are out and you're on your own. I think it makes the problem feel worse, and I think that you do tend to feel more depressed.
These feelings of depression among the lonely have been so severe that sometimes people have been tempted to consider committing suicide. Siobhan again.
Personally, I have come across people who have been contemplating suicide because the problems that they have, some people may have mental health problems, they may have physical problems, and if they feel that they have nobody to share that with, they do sometimes wonder what the point of carrying on is. Now, when we're on the end of the telephone, or when we're there to go around and make a visit and to talk it through with them and give them some degree of hope, that there is hope on the horizon and there is a reason to carry on with their life. Hopefully that doesn't make a difference and turn the situation around. But I personally have come across people on several occasions that have been contemplating suicide because life does seem so dark for them. And around and about, particularly if you watch the television, it gives the impression that everybody else is having a jolly good time.
When people slide into despair like this, Siobhan says she and other volunteers can help pull them back from the brink by offering their hand in friendship.
If we're able to spend time talking to somebody just to make them realise that life is worth living, then in their moment of despair, I think they feel that there is a glimmer of hope. We're not experts in anything in particular. What we are able to give is our time and our compassion and our commitment to people. And even though we're not experts, just being a fellow human being, sitting down and taking the time to talk to them, and to offer the hand of friendship and to reach out to them in their moments of need hopefully will do the trick and actually make them feel that life is worth carrying on with.
And he wanders home alone. So how can you tell me you're lonely?
Don't say for you. Not surprisingly, it's all too common for people living on their own to seek out companionship via the TV or even the internet. But as Monsignor Furnival explains, this can be a dangerous strategy.
Yes, if people are on the internet, I think that has become quite a feature of life, and television certainly dominates. But I think that ultimately, if that is their only diet, they lose the social skills, they lose the ability to interact and relate to others. I think this is where the church comes in, really, in terms of the local parish community, trying to reach out to people like that, bring them back in. Invite them to coffee mornings, as we do regularly for the bereaved, for example, and for those living alone, to relate them back to the community, because I think that's the great tragedy of the television, the internet, taking over people's lives. And it could do so for a whole vast range of people, and they lose that community sense, that sense of belonging, really, and become very isolated.
Siobhan agrees with him, and told me that sometimes the TV and computer can encourage lonely people to lose track of reality.
The television now is available 24 hours a day, and I have known cases where people who have no other reason to get up will stay up by night watching television and sleep by day because of our 24-hour culture. People who don't work, who perhaps have been alienated by the rest of society, live in their homes and quite often only have the television to try and keep them company. I dealt with one case myself where a gentleman called Phil, who was a recovering alcoholic, was moved from a rehabilitation unit into his own accommodation, and he'd already alienated his family and friends because of his alcohol problem, and he was unemployable due to physical and mental problems. So because he was unable to drive and he had mobility problems, he was a virtual prisoner in his own home. Now, in that situation, day tends to merge into night. And we found with Phil that he was staying up during the night to watch television and then would sleep during the day, that his week had no structure, whereas we tend to live between Monday and Friday in a working environment and then use our leisure time at the weekend. For Phil, there was no weekend. One day was much the same as the next. Day was much the same as night. So what we were able to do was to go in and visit him, to take him out of his home so that he could see the outside world, so that he could have some structure in his life and look forward to our visit. And it was a time when he was able to sit down and chat to us and tell him about his experience in life. And he had an awful lot to say and an awful lot to give. And at the end of the day, we learn from our visits as well. We end up wiser and hopefully a little bit better by making the visits ourselves. It's a two-way process.
Christmas, as we all know, is a time of goodwill and fellowship that we traditionally spend with our families. But for those living on their own, it can be a season to dread, when those feelings of loneliness become even more acute.
Yes, I think the sense of isolation increases at Christmas because people look around, they see perhaps people going to parties, office parties, they see activity, they see consumerism in the shops, and they may not be able to access all that. And I think it must be an increasingly sad time, Christmas time, when there's an acute sense of that. Loss of a sense of belonging, really, at a time when ostensibly we should be very much emphasizing belonging and community, and the whole spirit of the Christmas message is to care for everybody. And I think the sense of need is so great at Christmas time.
And as Siobhan points out, there are far more people than we think who are forced to spend Christmas on their own.
There's many cases that we've dealt with where people might otherwise be totally on their own at Christmas. There was one particular case called Dorothy, and the St. Vincent de Paul Society members went out to visit Dorothy and to befriend her and to sit down and spend time with her. And it transpired that when Dorothy died, that we had actually been the only people to visit her. And there's many thousands of people like Dorothy who sit on their own all the time, and Christmas just exacerbates the feeling of loneliness that everybody else is together with their family and they're on their own.
In the all-night cafe at 11:15, same old man sitting there on his own.
I was speaking to Siobhan Garibaldi of the St. Vincent de Paul Society in London and Monsignor John Furnival, a parish priest in the Liverpool area.
So how can you tell me you're lonely? Don't say for you that the sun don't shine.
We now broadcast the 21st episode, or chapter, in our ongoing historical series where we look at the lives and legends of the people and places that went into the making of the Vatican throughout the centuries. The programme is written by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett. Today's episode is called The Return, and we learn how in the 14th century two women put pressure on Pope Gregory the 11th to return to Rome from Avignon.
The 14th century was a period of transition. Little by little, the old feudal order was breaking down.
In France and England, the peasants were in revolt. The movement towards freedom from serfdom was on its way.
There was a new aggressive social group composed of merchants, bankers, master artisans and professional men. The middle class had arrived.
The current ideals were power, riches, earthly glory. Culture, previously limited to ecclesiastics, was now predominantly secular. The foundations of humanism were laid.
There was an increasing use of national languages instead of Latin. It was the era of Piers Plowman and Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, of John Dunstable and the English School of Singing, of religious reformers Wycliffe and Huss, and a great upsurge of popular religious feeling.
Fashion, as always, reflected the times. In the wake of the plague, sudden wealth had come to many who made themselves conspicuous by wearing outlandish clothes.
In the East, the Sultan Bayezid, known as the Flash of Lightning, took an oath that he would not rest until the altar of St. Peter's had been transformed into a stall for his stallion.
For the papacy, there was a relief of the pressure from France, following on the English victories at Crecy and Poitiers. It was time to return home.
The first pope to return from the Avignon captivity was Urban V, and in June 1367 he took ship for Rome.
But Urban only stayed 3 years, returning to Avignon to die in 1370. During his Roman sojourn, he ordered a vast programme of restoration, and from St. Peter's transferred the heads of the apostles, duly encased in silver, to the Lateran Palace.
Urban's successor, Gregory the 11th, although dominated by the cardinals, was not to be held in France. He realised that if the papal states were not to be lost forever, return to Rome was imperative. Even while he lingered, pressure was put on him by the Romans themselves, who sent an embassy, saying that if he did not come, they would elect another pope, by the anti-papal risings throughout the church states in Italy, and by the intervention of two women.
The first, Bridget of Sweden, was a visionary, and on Gregory's election sent him a letter warning him of an early death if he didn't go to Rome. In her last vision, she saw the pope tied to a rope, which on one side was being pulled by a multitude, on the other by God alone. And God was pulling in the direction of Rome.
The second woman was Catherine of Siena, who in a number of celebrated letters appealed to Gregory to delay no longer. In March 1376, she wrote,
"Most holy, sweet, and dearest Father in Christ, sweet Jesus, your wretched and unworthy daughter Catherine, servant and slave of the servants of Jesus Christ, writes to you in his precious blood. Do not postpone your coming. Pay no heed to the devil. He knows he stands to lose and is doing his utmost to put obstacles in your way and rob you of what is yours by making you lose love and charity and preventing your coming. Come, I say, and do not wait for time, which does not wait for you. Show the manliness I expect from you. No more cowardice. Answer God's call to you to come and take possession of the place of the glorious shepherd St. Peter, whose vicar you still are, and then to raise the standard of the Holy Cross. So when this standard is raised, we shall be delivered from war, disputes, and iniquities, and the infidel people from their infidelity. In this way you will come, and then you will see the Holy Church reformed through the appointment of good pastors. You will restore to her the color of glowing charity she has lost. So much blood has been sucked out of her by wicked gluttons that she has gone pale all over. But take courage and come, Father. Do not keep the servants of God waiting any longer.
When Catherine was in Avignon on an embassy from Florence, she met Pope Gregory and urged him to fulfil what he had promised. He was further encouraged by the fact that Rome had not risen against the papal governors. He decided to risk the journey back.
Money was short, and he had to pawn his jewels. But at dawn on January the 17th, Feast of the Chair of Peter, the Pope entered Rome, guarded by 2,000 mercenaries and acclaimed by frantically cheering crowds.
But behind all the triumph and excitement, Gregory had seen the reality. A ruined city, where the population huddled in squalor and misery. Adam of Usk, who lived in lodgings near the Vatican, wrote that he used to watch wolves and dogs fighting each other near St. Peter's. But the Lateran was uninhabitable, and so the Pope took up residence in the new Vatican Palace, which from then on became his official home.
Gregory died only 2 months after his return, and before he was buried, the people were out on the streets clamouring for an Italian pope. Already in the pope's last hours, deputations from many Italian cities had visited the cardinals in their residences to make the same request.
For the whole of the 9 days' mourning, the demonstrations went on. Tension mounted, and the cardinals went in fear of their lives. By now, the mob had blockaded all the roads out of the city and immobilized the boats on the Tiber. They even built bonfires, threatening to burn the cardinals if they didn't give the people what they wanted.
On the evening of April the 7th, as the bells sounded for Vespers, the cardinals entered the conclave. St. Peter's Square and the steps of the Basilica were solid with shouting, gesticulating Romans.
The cardinals took a day to decide. There were only 16 of them present, mostly foreigners, but they had a hard task. Of the four Italian cardinals, two were from rebellious cities, Florence and Milan, and of the two Romans, one was too old and the other too young. They compromised and chose someone who was neither a cardinal nor in Rome at the time of the conclave, the Archbishop of Bari, who had been Chancellor of the Papal Curia under Gregory and was also well known to the French element.
Meanwhile, outside, the people were growing impatient, and the cardinals were startled to see spears thrusting up through the floorboards of the room where they were sitting. And before they could do anything, the mob had forced its way past the troops guarding the entrance.
Afraid of the crowd's anger, the cardinals sought to distract their attention. They dressed up the old Roman cardinal in papal robes and sat him on the throne. As the exultant people prostrated themselves at the feet of the bewildered old man, the rest of the conclave took advantage of the diversion to make a hasty getaway.
When the old cardinal revealed the truth, the people were furious, but by this time the cardinals were safely in Castel Sant'Angelo or in the surrounding countryside. And the following day, the magistrates reminded the Romans that an Italian had been elected and they must be satisfied. On Easter Sunday, Urban VI was solemnly enthroned.
The programme was written by Jill Bevilacqua and produced by Sean Patrick Lovett.
Well, that's all from Vatican Radio's English programme for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. Laudato Jesus Christus.